Accession number 30411, Mr. Claude Stefan Jarrett, Reel 3. Now, we were talking about your time building these ammunition depots, huge ammunition depots.
And soon after that, I was sent to a officer's depot for overseas services.
Waiting to be posted.
And I discovered at the depot that I was to go to India, which was strictly not to be told, but I discovered it, and I sent to the colonel that after all, the major, whoever was in charge, that after all I spoke German and English, and I could imagine that it might be more useful to send me to the into the second front and into Germany rather than India. So he took me off the draft and notified
so
the war office.
Was this in 44 by now, but before D-Day?
No, this was 43.
Still in 43. Okay.
This was summer 43.
So you didn't do the depot building very long?
Oh, quite a while. June, July, August, September. And then in September, I think it was, or October it could have been.
That's when you went to the officer's depot.
Right.
Now what about this? You didn't want to go to...
I didn't want to go to India at all.
Why not?
Because I felt more useful would be, with my knowledge of languages, to send me to France or wherever the Second Front was going to be developed or was developing or whatever. And the officer in charge took me off the draft and notified the War Office, and the War Office sent him a very rude letter. He had no right to take me off. They had decided where I was to go, and it was not up to me. I had decided that I'd go anywhere, wherever I was sent. I had signed that paper whilst I was there for the interview, and they would send me wherever they had need. So at Christmas, I was put on overseas leave again, and I left on the 13th of January for India.
1944.
44.
Now, what do you remember the trip out?
The trip out was a huge mile-long troop train driving from where I was in Leamington, or Leamington Spa, whatever you call it.
The depot, so the officer's depot.
Oh, no, you're quite right. I had gone to the depot. The depot was somewhere in the Midlands, I forget where. And the train, we discovered, was going to Scotland. Where was it going? To Glasgow. And we, all over the place, we stopped all night long and picked up troops. And we ended up with an enormous full load of troops on that troop train and got there early in the morning. And unloaded by section, by numbers. There were mostly other ranks, not officers. There were quite a few officers on it. And on the 13th of January, we weighed anchor and left Glasgow for overseas.
You don't know the name of the ship?
Yeah. Otranto. O-T-R-
I know that one.
A-N-T-O, Otranto. I think it was an old P&O liner, and I was one of the officers on that ship.
And what were conditions like on the journey?
Unbelievable.
In what way?
We slept four tiers high, and you couldn't turn around. If you went in on your back, you stayed on your back, because between the distance, you couldn't turn. The distances were less than the shoulder width. So if you were on your back, you stayed on your back. If you went in on your belly, you stayed on your belly. Or if you wanted to turn around, you had to get out. And we walked on all the cases that were on luggage between the beds. On either side, I was in one of the nice, beautifully furnished lounges of the ship, which had been turned into, as you can see, a sort of, I don't really know how to describe it, unbelievable number of beds. And we had 70...
And you were an officer?
When I was an officer. And we had 75 female nurses on the ship, and we had about a couple of thousand men, over 2,000 men. I had volunteered right at the beginning. They announced, and as you know, volunteering is not a strong side in the army. They had asked for a volunteer messing officer, and I had volunteered. And so, as ship's messing officer, the ship was dry. There was no liquor at all on board. But I met the chief steward of the company running the ship, the management. And he was a very nice chap. And as a member of the crew, he was allotted his ration of liquor. And he shared it with me, and we had drinks together and chatted by the hour and on this very long trip.
So and what did you have to actually do as messing officer?
I had to ask for complaints at mealtimes, go around with the duty officer and ask at all the tables any complaints about the food or anything else. And there were always some, and you had to deal with these complaints. And sometimes they involved the type of food or the quality of food or whatever, or other things that people were complaining about. And you had to see whether there was anything you could do to help or to improve or to deal with the difficulties that they complained about. And I did that for the entire trip and had a very nice time with the staff. And
remember the route, which way you went?
Yeah, to just off New York, turned around and went through the Mediterranean. And we landed at Mediterranean Suez Canal. We landed in Suez, and we landed in, what's the town at the southeast corner of Yemen?
Aden.
Aden. We landed in Aden. Not off the ship, of course, weren't allowed off. But they came and tried to sell us stuff in Suez and in Aden. And then we stopped in Bombay on the 13th of February, 44.
Now, what were your first impressions of India then?
Oh, I had... We were allowed disembarkation for a week in this camp where we, from the ship, were allowed to stay. And of course, it was very hot and very sunny in Bombay in February 44. And we ended up the color of that leather there because we didn't know how strong the sun was, and that the sun burned through the water. We spent hours swimming outside in the beautiful hot spring water in the ocean, and came out and looked, honestly, we didn't realize it. Nobody told us that the sun burns through the water. And so
you were bright red.
Oh, bright red. This color here, absolutely. And I had had a lot of tooth trouble on the ship with bleeding gums. What do you call it? It's got a name.
Dismal.
Anyway, and I went to see the dentist, European dentist, somebody recommended in Bombay, and he immediately fixed it up for me, and I got rid of the bleeding gums. God, I forget the name of the illness. Anyway, I got it on the ship from badly cleaned crockery and cutlery and caught it off somebody else. And that was it. And then we got a interview with a staff officer from New Delhi, from GHQ, who was going to do postings. And he, on the same draft, not on the same ship, on another ship, but on the same draft, was the colonel who was in charge of building the depot in Leamington Spa, Colonel Emerson. And I'd seen him there and said to Colonel Emerson, would he put in a good word for me with the posting officer? I remember the name now, Major Haslam, H-A-S-L-A-M, Major Haslam. And he said, sure he would. And Haslam called me out and said he had a very nice posting for me if I wanted it, and I could pick another friend, and the two of us could go to Northern Assam. I said, where's Assam? And he showed it to me on the map. I'd never heard of it. And he said, you'll have to go to Calcutta. That'll take you a week or 10 days to book that trip. You'll have to do that through the rail transport officer. And then from Calcutta, you'll be sent north. So I said, okay, thank you very much. And I picked a friend of mine from the draft, and we said we'd go together. And a couple of 3 days later, Jared. So I went, and Haslam said, Mr. Jared, I have news for you. You can't go to Assam, but I have two empty postings at GHQ New Delhi. Would you enjoy one of them? So I said, certainly, whatever you think is interesting and nice to do, I'll do.
So now as a engineer officer, staff officer.
So I said, I'll accept that gladly. And by the time I got to New Delhi, actually, I think I had two pips. I had a full lieutenancy. Took 6 months from first commissioning to being appointed a full lieutenant with two pips. When you first commission, you only have one pip. So I said yes.
Now, what were your duties going to be at the GHQ New Delhi?
He told me that I would get all the instructions about New Delhi in Delhi. So I got to New Delhi and reported, and the man who interviewed me said that I was to work with a major Lumsdaine, L-U-M-S-D-A-I-N-E, Major Lumsdaine. And he said, Major Lumsdaine will brief you on the details of the requirement, but you'll be working for him and with him. And Major Lumsdaine, I discovered afterwards, was born and bred in the Argentine of parents that had gone there to build the railways at the beginning of the 1900s. And he was born there and had volunteered for the Indian Army from Buenos Aires, been sent to England by boat from Buenos Aires, where he was in England commissioned without any training at all into the Indian Army as a major, and shipped out from England round South America, South Africa, to India. And he had gotten to India to be commissioned into the, be a part of the Indian Army. And very nice chap. He got on very well. I worked with him for 2 years in the Stores Directorate of the Royal Engineers. And our main job was to look after, I think we had about five huge depots of Royal Engineer stores distributed all over India. And when we got stores shipped, to allocate these stores to where they were required by the army. And that was our job, to account for these stores and to look after them and when required to issue them to the units that needed the stores that we had ordered for them.
And what kind of things were in the stores?
Well, some of them shovels and all the usual stuff, and engineering stores like bridge building stuff and road building stuff. And
it would go as high as Bailey Bridges then?
All that and all kinds of engineering stores. We did not do artillery stores or that sort of thing, and we didn't do medical. But we did all the stuff, and we didn't do ammunition, for instance, but we did all the stuff that to build tents and to build any kind of building activity that we looked after and that was needed, that it wasn't available from local sources, that had to be shipped in from England or overseas. And you try to find them from the ship's manifests and allocate them immediately to where they were to be sent, and the docking companies that looked after this had to be instructed where to send it and what to do about it and so on. And that was Bob Lumsdaine's job and mine. And I did that throughout the 2 years and a quarter that I spent in New Delhi. That was my job.
How many did you have to help you?
How many?
Did you have to help you with this job?
Oh, we had Indian staff. Large numbers of Indian staff, but there were just those two officers, him and me.
So everybody else was Indian. How did you get on with the Indian personnel?
Oh, very well. We had no trouble with them. I mean, the Indian staff that worked for us were reliable and were honest. And we had one very nice man. He was the chief of administration in the High Court in Rangoon. He was from Burma, and a very nicely spoken gentleman, elderly gentleman, who had volunteered for this job from Burma and come out of Burma and joined the general headquarters on a civilian basis, and he was with us, a very nice chap. And lots of other clerks and people who were needed, accounting sections and so on and so forth. And we had a colonel above us and then a general. General in charge was General Room, R-O-O-M. And the colonel, God, I can't remember his name.
Doesn't matter too much. Now, what about your living accommodation? Where were you living in? You were in New Delhi. Were you
in New Delhi. At the first accommodation I had was very temporary. That they had no vacancy or anything, and then I lived in a very nice officer's mess at number 4 Aurangzeb Road, upstairs on the balcony for 2 years in the open.
What was it like?
Pretty cold at Christmas, but very nice. I enjoyed it, the open air, and Christmas time I had two or three blankets, and in the summer I slept under a mosquito net with one sheet on me. That was it. And nice food, nice place, and very pleasant to stay.
Now, what was the office? Were you part of the officer's mess in the sense of, do you remember what sort of life you had in the mess?
Oh, very nice mess. I had joined the Imperial Delhi Gymkhana Club and went swimming in their pool, and it was a very pleasant place to live. And I had a bicycle as means of transportation. And when I left in the summer, in April, May, June, when I left my office, by the time I got to the mess, which was 7, 8, 9 minutes away on the bicycle, I couldn't touch the handlebar. It was so hot. I burnt my fingers to give you some idea of what it was like.
Did you get used to the climate?
No, you can't really get used to the climate. It's impossible. The hottest period was in May of 1944, and it went up, the temperature went up in the shade to 115 degrees Fahrenheit. So give you some idea of what we had to deal with. And the temperature at night was in the high 40s. So, I mean, it was really very hot indeed and very difficult circumstances. And one had to be very careful.
Can I just remove these?
Now, were you aware of the background of what was going on with the war with Japan?
Oh, yes, very much so. And the biggest job we had was to prepare for the big landing in 1945.
The one that was cancelled? Well, we
in
went
Rangoon.
Ahead.
We had.
Now, how did you prepare for that?
Well, we had demands made for stores that we had for the troops. And, I mean, the troops were to land on enemy-occupied land. So you, after the first fight with the guns and the ships and the landing craft, etc., what was needed was accommodation to cover, to build tents, etc., etc. We had all kinds of stuff that we had to deal with that kept us going, and of course we prepared for it all. And of course the minute that they were all at sea, the Japanese collapsed because the atomic bomb was dropped, and it never came to any landing that had been envisaged because there wasn't anybody there. The Japanese all fled.
Did you have any celebrations on VE Day?
Lots of celebrations.
Well, how did you celebrate?
Well, we all celebrate by having drinks and food and all that, and we had a victory parade and so on.
Was it special for you in the sense that, you know, you were Jewish, Hitler,
no,
the rest of it?
No,
you didn't
that just didn't enter into it at all, particularly not with the Japanese. But
I meant with VE Day. Well,
we all fought, we all were active, but I mean, it was the end of Hitler, was the end of the war and all that. I had met, one met socially, of course, locally with British people who were there before the war and who lived in India. And
how did you get on with them? I mean,
very well. I had a friend, for instance, Mrs. Anita Ames, who was of Scottish background, and I met her through the Delhi Club, Gymkhana Club, and so on. So one met local people, one met other people, and there were a couple of refugees there whom we met. A chap by the name of Henry Wolfe, who had been there since, I don't know, sometime in the 30s, and who was active building factories for the Tatars and the Birlas, etc., with that sort of thing. And one met other people. I had a girlfriend whom I met on the ship, one of the nurses, Monica Hallam, Sister Hallam, and we kept up a very close friendship for the 2 years I spent in India, went on holiday together, that sort of thing, and she was a very nice person and very nice to be with. And
what were the clubs like? You know, the Gymkhana Club?
Very nice, and we were regarded as full members, no problem, nothing quite, you know, not different or anything else. And they had opened their doors to the troops and to the officers.
Was it to just the officers? Or was
only
it
officers. And I had met some of the other ranks, and we used to play bridge. Quite a lot of bridge was played.
What about the club? What facilities did they offer, you know?
Oh, swimming pools particularly. That was the main effort, was in pools. Swimming pools were lovely. They had nice pool arrangement, and if you wanted to play bridge, bring three friends in and have a table for bridge. You know, that sort of thing was always available. And meals. They offered meals. They had nice kitchens with nice meals. And sometimes there was dancing, musical activities. It was nice. Enjoyed it very much. Socially, the time in New Delhi was nice and a pleasant time. And
how did you get on with the Indians themselves? You know, we talked about your workers, but what about the? Did you mix with the general population much?
No, they didn't mix with us. On the contrary, they were mostly full of animosity. The Brits were not regarded. I mean, for them, we were all British. There was no difference, and the Brits were not regarded kindly. I mean, when, for instance, the movie finished in the movie theater. It finished, the Queen was played, or the King, as it was then, the King was played, the national anthem. And mostly the Indians got up and walked out. And that was always a steady activity to stop the Indians from walking out. And you put your foot out so that hopefully they would stumble over your foot and fall down on the floor. I mean, that's the sort of activity that I can...
Was there any other sign of it? Because there were riots and
Later.
But were you aware of this going on?
Oh, yes, we were very much aware.
When did the riots start? I mean, did they not... Or was that a bit later?
I don't know. I couldn't really tell you. But not anymore. But all I can say is that they were full of animosity towards us. They didn't want us to have a pleasant time. And they didn't want us to be there at all. They wanted us pushed out.
Now, were there any celebrations at the end of the Japanese War, of course?
Yes. There was the final victory day celebrations. And, of course, there was the Viceregal Lodge. And there was all kinds of activities connected with the government and so on and so forth. The one item that I recall very clearly, which you probably never even heard of, was Canada is very concerned about a blow-up of some size in Halifax years ago. Something blew up in Canada years ago and killed a lot of people. I forget the details because I wasn't there at the time. I think it was 1919 or 1918 or something, and killed an awful lot of people. And we had a ship brought into Bombay Harbor, the Fort Stikine, Stikine, sometime in 44 or early 45, I forget the date. This ship had a load of 5,000 tons of ammunition on it, which was not destined for the engineers, but for the military, and loaded en route cotton on top of the ammunition. Well, in civilian life, they don't do that in case the cotton catches fire. This time, the cotton caught fire after the ship had docked in Bombay, and the ship with its 5,000 tons of ammunition blew up and killed I don't know how many people. We never found out really how many. I don't think they ever knew how many hundred died.
Now, where were you at that time? Were you
in Bombay.
You were in Bombay at that time. Was that when you just first got there then?
No, this was some months later, many months later. But it was the most enormous damage that was caused because this 5,000 tons blew up. They couldn't extinguish the fire in time to prevent the thing blowing up.